This isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to harlemglobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.
Please remember that any individual referenced in the podcast should be considered innocent until found guilty in a court of law, and any opinions or views expressed in the podcast are solely those of participants. Some of the content discussed in the podcast may contain violence or graphic descriptions and may not be suitable for all audiences. Listener discretion is advised.
On December 5, 1978, winter settled over Mississippi's Gulf Coast. The day it peaked at 59 degrees, but by nightfall, the air had dropped to a sharp 36. The roads lay still and silent. And along Ladner Road, one of the few lights breaking the darkness came from a small brick convenience store, its wide glass windows glowing like a beacon in the night. Inside, 20-year-old Deborah Gunner worked the graveyard shift at the Little General Store. Fluorescent lights hummed overhead. The cooler droned in the back. It was the lonely soundtrack of another midnight shift. Deborah believed it was her chance to build something better for herself and for her husband. But Deborah was young, determined, still searching for her own peace and happiness. And then, sometime in the dark hours before dawn, she was gone. The Little General Store once promised shoppers that it only takes a minute. For Deborah, those words became something else entirely, because a minute was all it took for everything to change. 4 days later, her body was discovered in the woods of McIntosh, Alabama, 85 miles from the store. It was a brutal murder that has haunted two states for more than four decades. The truth has never come out of the shadows. This is the story of Deborah Gunner and the search for answers that has never stopped.
Hey guys, and welcome back. We want to take a moment to talk about something that reaches far beyond this case, something rooted in hope and perseverance and in the belief that even in the darkest chapters, a spark can still take hold. We're talking about Operation Safe Return.
Operation Safe Return is our statewide commitment to bring missing children and vulnerable adults back into public view, to make sure their faces don't fade or disappear into silence. It's a reminder that every life carries a spark worth protecting.
And this isn't a quick campaign. What we're building is meant to last. A line of light stretching across the state, one billboard, one face, one family at a time. We set a goal of $12,000 this year, and thanks to so many of you, we've already passed the 1,000 mark. That early support, that's the spark.
Because when awareness spreads, when a memory awakens, when a detail finally breaks loose, that's the flame. And when the flame moves from person to person, community to community, billboard to billboard, that's when the fire takes hold.
If you want to help build something enduring, you can text OSR to 53555.
This is how a spark becomes a flame.
This is how a flame becomes a wildfire.
And together, this is how we guide them home. And now for episode 4, The Line Marked Suspect. Before we begin, I want to offer a very important note. In this episode, we walk through documents from the Alabama Department of Forensic Sciences. Records that describe the crime scene and the injuries Deborah suffered. These details are graphic. They are deeply upsetting, and they speak to the brutality of her murder. We share them not for shock value, but because they are a part of her story and part of understanding what happened to her. Please take care while listening and step away if you need to.
Over the last several weeks, we've been submitting public record requests to multiple agencies, digging, calling, and trying to track down anything that might still exist from 1978. Washington County did return our call, but their investigator told us they were unable to locate any records connected to Deborah's case. Given that the Alabama State Bureau of Investigation, now SBI, formerly ABI, also assisted in the original investigation, we're checking there as well. A few documents have come in, others we're still waiting on. But one agency did respond with something substantial, the Alabama Department of Forensic Sciences, or DFS. And the records they sent offer the clearest look we've had yet into what investigators were documenting in those first hours and days of Deborah's case.
That context matters because early newspaper reports were unusually detailed. The number of stab wounds, the type of weapon believed to be used, that Deborah was found partially nude and bound, that investigators suspected more than one person. Information that may have been premature and shaped the public's understanding in ways that lingered for decades.
But to understand what DFS recorded and what they didn't, we need to trace the path investigators were following in those first days, the sequence of events that carried us from Deborah's overnight shift at the Little General to the moment her body was found in the woods outside McIntosh. On December 5th, 1978, Deborah reported for her overnight shift at the Little General on Ladner Road. Her shift ran from 11 p.m. to 7 a.m., and several witnesses later confirmed seeing her during the first half of her shift. Then came the robberies. At 3:41 a.m., the Little General on 14th Street was robbed by a man holding a small automatic gun in his left hand. He asked for a pack of cigarettes, then calmly said, "This is a holdup," and then he fled on foot. He was described as a white male between the ages of 23 and 24, about 5'7 to 5'8, and around 150 pounds, with blonde shoulder-length hair, a worn green field jacket, and blue jeans.
At 3:53 a.m., another Little General was robbed by a different man, this one at Eden and Old Mobile. He asked for cigarettes, then told the clerk, "Give me all your money," keeping his right hand in his pocket as though holding a weapon. He was a white male, around 25 years old, about 5'9 to 5'10, 180 to 190 pounds, reddish-orange collar-length hair, a pockmarked face, a thin mustache, and a mouth that looked slightly crooked when he talked, almost as if he was trying to smile.
Two robberies, two men, two descriptions, strikingly similar in age, size, and clothing. One left-handed, one right-handed, both wearing worn green jackets, possibly even the same jacket if they were working together, and both asking for the same brand of cigarettes, Raleigh's. At 4 a.m., Mitchell Hill stopped at the Little General on Ladner Road, where Deborah should have been working, and found the store empty. He called out for the clerk. No response. At 4:05, the store manager called the store. Still no answer. At 4:26, Hill returned with Deputy Mike Diamond. Deborah's car was still in the parking lot. Her purse and sweater were still inside, but the cash register was missing about $50. There were no signs of a struggle, no indication of where she went. For the next 4 days, the community waited, suspended between hope and fear. At around 4 p.m. on December 9th, a McIntosh resident reported news no one wanted to hear. A body had been found in the woods off Highway 43. The search for Deborah came to a devastating end.
Historical weather data shows that December 9th was overcast and windy, with about a half inch of rain earlier that morning, enough to soften dirt roads, blur impressions, and leave the forest floor heavy with damp pine straw. Temperatures had swung from a high of 76 degrees to a low of 31, sunset at 4:52 p.m., civil twilight ending at 5:20 p.m.
By the time DFS toxicologist James Small arrived at 6:30 p.m., the woods were fully dark. The kind of cold, damp darkness that absorbs light and sound. He met Deputy Farrell Grimes, Assistant DA Edward Turner, Sergeant A.L. Abbott of ABI, and McIntosh police officers. They followed a dirt road beside the remains of an old drive-in theater, and then made their way another 75 feet into the woods where Deborah's body was discovered. Small documented the scene. Her left shoe lay 12 inches from her bare left foot, still tied. Her blue jeans and right shoe were the only clothing left on her body. Her hands were bound behind her back with her blouse, bra, and a knee-length stocking. The matching stocking was found in her mouth. A cigarette lighter was underneath her. Her body was cold to the touch. And beneath her, liquid blood rested on top of the pine straw, not dried, not absorbed. A detail that strongly suggests she had not been there long.
Small observed multiple stab wounds to the neck, a compression groove around the throat, and abrasions under the chin, consistent with ligature. But what is equally striking is what he did not document. No footprints, no tire impressions, no drag marks, no disturbed soil, no details about the environment. Maybe the rain erased them. Maybe they were never there. Maybe they simply weren't recorded.
Sometimes the silence in a report carries its own weight. Small concluded the scene summary with one final line. The body is removed from the scene by Smith Ambulance and transported to Westside Funeral Home in Mobile.
Hey, hockey fans! Can't get enough hockey? Then get more with Team USA. When you crave the fast-paced, hard-hitting action on the ice, but you don't always love the big league price, then Team USA has you covered with all the thrills and all the energy at USA Hockey Arena in Plymouth, and all at a family-friendly price. Get more fun and more hockey when Team USA hosts exciting NCAA, international, and USHL opponents. Grab your tickets now at usahockeyntdp.com and see America's NHL stars of tomorrow.
This isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to harlemglobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.
Here's where the timing becomes critical. Deborah's body was reported at 4 p.m. Small arrived at the scene at 6:30 p.m., and the autopsy began at 8:20 p.m. It had previously been reported that Deborah's body had been transported from the scene at 6 p.m., but that couldn't possibly be true if Small's reports are accurate. That's 1 hour and 50 minutes between his arrival and the start of the autopsy. The drive from McIntosh to Mobile today takes 48 minutes.
Subtract transport, handoff, preparation, and the time spent actually processing the scene may have been 30 to 40 minutes, possibly less.
Whether investigators return later, we don't know. But based on the DFS documentation, the first, and possibly only, scene examination that night was extremely brief. And it raises a difficult question. Did investigators have enough time to see everything that mattered? Small began the autopsy at 8:20 p.m. Before he did, he noted that Deborah's body was identified by her father-in-law, Thomas Gunner. Not her husband, not her parents, her father-in-law. A detail with a quiet heaviness that leaves one question hanging in the air. Where was her husband?
Small documented multiple insect bites on Deborah's arms, abdomen, and chest, along with very immature maggots in her hair, eye, mouth, and nasal passages. With daytime temperatures reaching 76 degrees, insect activity would have begun quickly, even in December. This didn't mean that she'd been in the woods for days, but she had not been placed there moments before the discovery.
Small removed the tampon still inserted. There were no injuries to the vaginal area and no signs of sexual assault. He collected swabs, but there's no indication he swabbed her mouth or anal region, meaning sexual assault can only be partially ruled out. He then documented a pattern of abrasions. Two on the right side of her chin, aligned lateral, two on the left side of her chest, parallel, nearly identical, and less than an inch apart. Not random, not chaotic.
Then came the neck. Small documented 32 separate stab wounds to the front of Deborah's throat, each between a quarter and 3/8 of an inch, all running transversely, side to side, all made by a single-edged weapon with the blade's sharp edge facing towards the right side of her neck.
Internally, the injuries were catastrophic. A cut to the left internal jugular vein, two cuts to the left common carotid artery, a cut to the thyroid gland, and a cut to the left innominate artery. Her heart contained very little blood, meaning her body had lost almost everything.
Small also found hemorrhage around the larynx and trachea, penetrating wounds inside both, and blood with mucus deep in the main stem and secondary bronchi. Blood this deep enters the airway in one of two ways. One, the victim is alive, even briefly, struggling to breathe during the attack. Two, if catastrophic neck trauma occurs and the body is moved after death, gravity can draw blood into the airway.
Small also documented a well-defined compression groove a quarter inch in width around her neck. Her hands bound, her mouth gagged, ligature marks on her neck, and 32 stab wounds. A sequence of violence no one could confuse or explain away.
DFS criminalist Elaine Scott completed her lab work earlier on December 28th. Scott examined the vaginal swab and the tampon. Neither disclosed spermatozoa. She also examined two knives submitted by Officer Ray Jones of the Satsuma Police Department, which raises its own questions since Satsuma wasn't the investigating jurisdiction. One knife was a three-bladed buck pocket knife, the other a Rapala fillet knife. Both tested positive on a presumptive test for blood, but further testing was inconclusive due to insufficient sample.
Two blood-positive knives, no spermatozoa, and an autopsy full of injuries that did not point to a sexual motive. Some questions were answered, but others were newly created. After recording this episode, we provided Deborah's autopsy report to two medical professionals we trust and regularly consult with on questions like these, Dr. Mont Hiley and Dr. David Thrasher, who served as a county coroner for nearly 15 years. We asked them to help us understand how several of the findings documented by James Small would have occurred physiologically. Both explained that the presence of blood deep in the airway, specifically in the main stem and secondary bronchi, would be consistent with aspiration. In medical terms, aspiration occurs when a person inhales blood into the lungs while still breathing. They also noted that the very small amount of blood found in Deborah's heart suggests circulation was occurring during the trauma, meaning blood was actively being lost rather than simply settling after death. When we asked about the bruising documented in the report, both said the severity of the trauma makes it difficult to identify a single cause with certainty. However, they explained the injuries could be consistent with an altercation, either from struggling or from direct blows, though no specific mechanism can be conclusively determined from the findings alone. Dr. Thrasher also told us it was possible Deborah's body had been in the woods the entire time prior to discovery. When we asked whether insect activity could be used as a guide in estimating time of death, he offered the following general framework. Eggs alone typically indicate death within approximately 24 hours. Small maggots suggest a time frame of up to 3 days, and larger maggots are generally associated with a period of 3 to 7 days. These are not exact measurements, but guideposts. One piece of a much larger puzzle. We're sharing this context to clarify how medical professionals interpret these findings and to be clear where the science informs our understanding and where uncertainty remains. When we received the DFS autopsy documents, something caught our attention. Not in the finding, not even in the injury descriptions. It was in the header, a place meant for only the case number and the subject of the report, and yet on its own separate line was a second name. Beside it, one word, suspect. It's a name that appears in the investigative file, but lightly, briefly really. The kind of mention that feels more like a checked box than a true lead, and nothing in the autopsy explains why his name is here, elevated in the state's own forensic paperwork tied directly to Deborah's case. That name is Norman David Taylor.
If you have any information regarding the abduction and murder of Deborah Gunter, please contact the Jackson County Sheriff's Office by phone at 228-769-3063 or through their mobile app. You may also submit an anonymous tip through Mississippi Coast Crime Stoppers via telephone at 877-787-5898 or through their website, which is linked in the episode description.
Since Alabama Cold Case Advocacy's creation, we have dedicated innumerable hours to researching and networking in an effort to provide the largest platform we can to the cases we share. We shoulder all associated expenses with Alabama Cold Case Advocacy out of our own pocket, including the subscription fees for researching and production of the Unforgotten podcast to provide a cost-free avenue for the victims' families of those cases.
We hope you will join in our efforts to raise awareness of Alabama's missing and murdered and support these families who have been forced to carry the immeasurable loss of their loved ones and the fight for answers. If you appreciate our mission and you are inspired to make a donation, your extra support will enable the ACCA to continue our research, share the cold cases, and help those families know that they are also unforgotten.
Unforgotten is an Alabama Cold Case Advocacy podcast recorded in conjunction with Riverside FM, hosted and distributed by Red Circle to your favorite podcast platforms. Content, research, artwork, and production are by Sellers and Stormy of Alabama Cold Case Advocacy. Credits for music, sound clips, special mentions, and research sources can be found in each episode's description. Your support helps us continue producing Unforgotten and further Alabama Cold Case's mission of advocacy and awareness. There are a few ways you can help us light the path. Make a one-time or monthly donation to Unforgotten through Red Circle, sign up for a one-time or recurring donation through the ACCA website, or subscribe to the Unforgotten Patreon channel for early access to ad-free episodes. You will find the links for all three in our episode descriptions. Another cost-free way to be of great help is to follow us on social media, but most importantly, whatever you do, tell everyone you know about these cases. Sharing their stories is one of the most effective ways to help find resolution for Alabama's cold cases. Be the spark. Thank you for listening, and until next time, remember, justice may be delayed, but the victims and their families remain unforgotten.
That was good. You did good on that one.
Thanks.
This isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to HarlemGlobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.